Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, new Maricopa County Sheriff Jerry Sheridan on immigration enforcement in the jails and the legacy of Joe Arpaio.
And after years of rejecting them, why a young adult author finally took an idea for a book someone gave him.
But first, Governor Katie Hobbs is expected to issue her first veto of the year this week, as lawmakers send her a bill they argue would lead to faster election results. She's already signaled her opposition to the measure. With me, as he is every Monday during the legislative session to talk about what to expect this week at the state capitol, is Howie Fisher of Capitol Media Services. And Howie, the governor is going to dust off that veto stamp in the coming days, huh?
I'm telling you, she's falling behind. If she's going to hit that 140 plus that she did her first year, she's going to have to up her game here. Of course, the other half of it is they haven't sent her a lot of bills. I think what the Republican legislature is hoping to do is send a lot of stuff to the ballot and say, sorry, Governor, we don't care about you. This is one that is going to be an issue on the ballot specifically. The question is, do folks want election results earlier? Or is that just the TV and radio stations? And are they willing to give up being able to drop off their early ballots on election day by just walking in, putting the little green envelope into the slot, and walking away? The belief of Republican lawmakers is that we really need earlier results. But it comes down to a philosophical question of, is it important enough for people to be able to drop off their ballots on election day without having to stand in line with everyone else? The governor's made it clear, and sometime today she's going to veto the bill. And then sometime later today, the House is going to pass out their ballot measure version. And I'm sure it has the votes. It'll go to the Senate, and then it will go on the 2026 ballot.
So, Howie, also later today, there's going to be some discussion, both at a press conference and in a committee, about a bill that would allow law enforcement to basically shoot out drones from the sky. Is that right?
That's right. It says that it would allow law enforcement to intercept, capture, disable, shooting, destroying, or otherwise rendering inoperative an unmanned aircraft, i.e. a drone, within 15 miles of the border without having any liability. Now, the concern by law enforcement is that folks are using these drones to, if nothing else, to spy on police, to find out where they are, to find out how to get people across the border. They may even be smuggling the drugs on them. I mean, it's sort of the Amazon style of delivery of what they're doing with drones in some cases. The question becomes, where is the line about what is reasonable? If you've got an officer firing up into the air and shooting down a drone, and it not only damages the drone based solely on their quote unquote reasonable suspicion that the drone was doing something illegal, or if it hurts somebody on the ground, should they be entitled to immunity? And, you know, this comes down to a law and order question versus a really kind of question to me.
So, Howie, also later today, there's a committee in the House that's going to be taking up a bill that would ask the federal government to allow the state to deny recipients of SNAP, basically food stamps, to use those benefits to buy soda?
Yes, this is an extension of something that Leo Biasucci, a state representative from Havasu City, is doing about school lunches, where he says, why are we filling kids full of chemicals, you know, red dye number 30 and green dye number 6. This says that if we're going to have government subsidized food, and there's a lot of reasons for the what they call supplemental nutrition assistance program, why should we let it be spent on something that has no nutritional value and may have some negative value? Now, originally, Representative Biasucci also had added candy to that list. I think the tricky part there is there are a lot of quote-unquote nutrition bars that could be classified as candy based on I don't know the sweeteners that they have. So he decided, I'm not going to pick that fight. I'm going to go after the low-hanging fruit, which is sodas.
Sure. Howie, let's talk a little bit about a potential change to the death penalty. This, of course, has been a pretty big issue since the little controversy over the governor removing the retired judge that she had asked to review the state's death penalty before he was able to file his full report. This is a bill that would replace the state's current method of execution, which is lethal injection, with a firing squad.
This is in some ways a repeat of what happened years and years ago. We used to use, well, way back when, you know, you would hang people and that was the end of it. The state replaced that with the gas chamber, and then there were some incidents there where people were choking to death, literally. But folks said, if the idea of putting somebody to death is to keep them from bothering society, if you will, again, there'd have to be more humane ways to do that. So the idea was lethal injections. Well, what we've seen is, on occasion, lethal injections have also proven to be perhaps less inhumane. So what the Judge Duncan said is, if you want something that's humane, that's going to be instantaneous, is very simple, you know, firing squad. That has raised a lot of issues. I think it's a question of, you know, are we ready to go back to something that seemed to be, you know, from the 18th century, if you will. What Representative Culloden's proposes, it's real simple. If, in fact, we're concerned about the gas chamber, if, in fact, we're concerned about lethal injection, if, in fact, we're concerned about hanging, let the voters decide. Let's make this the legal method and the only legal method, and let the voters vote on it.
So, Howie, finally, another issue that might go before voters, and this one's also gotten a lot of attention, especially recently, a proposal to eliminate legislative immunity just for traffic violations. So if a lawmaker during session is stopped for speeding, they could, in fact, get a ticket.
Well, that's exactly it. And obviously, this keeps coming up. I mean, we saw just this past week with Representative Jake Hoffman out on the superstition getting ticketed for 89 in a 65 zone. He did not ask for immunity, but the officer recognized who he was and said, okay, I'm going to note that in my book and you get to go on your way. I think the public is a little fed up with the idea that you get to kind of just say, sorry, officer, you can't ticket me. And so Representative Quan Nguyen from Prescott Valley said, let's put this on the ballot. Let's let voters decide whether we need legislative immunity. The whole purpose of legislative immunity from arrest was to make sure that some rogue sheriff's deputy did not stop a lawmaker from getting to the Capitol to vote on a certain bill. Representative Nguyen says, look, you know, everybody has a cell phone now. You know, we can call up the speaker and say, delay that bill until I get in there. It seems to have been abused over the years. And I think voters may have finally had enough. Now, the question becomes, can Representative Nguyen get enough votes in the House and Senate to do that? Because I think there are a few lawmakers who say, well, you know, we really don't want to go ahead and disturb this here. And do we really want to put this on the ballot? As you say, it'll face its first test today in his committee. I assume he believes he has the votes. And then now we see, can it get out of the full House? Can it get out of the Senate?
Absolutely. All right. That is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, lots, as always, to watch at the Capitol. Thank you for taking the time to talk about it.
You're very welcome.
The legacy of Sheriff Joe Arpaio casts a big shadow over Maricopa County's newest sheriff, Jerry Sheridan. Sheridan was Arpaio's chief deputy, and he was implicated in the court case over the office's racial profiling of Latino citizens in Maricopa County, even held in contempt of court in the process. But he says now that he disagreed with Arpaio's targeted approach to law enforcement, and he isn't planning on assisting any further with the Trump administration's mass deportation efforts. The office is, after all, still under the court order that case resulted in today. In fact, it's one of the reasons the last Maricopa County sheriff left office early. Paul Penzone, the Democrat who ousted Arpaio, called the court-appointed monitor that still oversees MCSO the, quote, one cloud still hanging over this office. He was also held in contempt of court for failing to comply with the court's order. Now, Sheridan wants to work to rebuild the trust that has broken down between his office and the Latino community that remembers so-called saturation patrols and traffic stops for broken headlights. He came into our studios recently to talk more about that and his approach to the current anti-immigrant environment, immigration roundups, and workplace raids. And it's today's Deep Dive.
Well, first off, we have not been asked by the federal government to become involved in their endeavor. But we do have two ICE agents that are embedded in our intake process. So when somebody gets arrested, they come off the street by Phoenix PD or any of the 22 municipalities, they'll bring them in our intake, and we get about 250 a day on average. Every one of those 250 people have to go to and talk to the ICE agents. Mm-hmm. They double check for their residency status, their citizen status, or that kind of thing. So everyone that comes through our system gets checked by ICE. And sometimes they'll put a detainer on them, and it's up to them. And they usually average about maybe 10 a day that they'll put a detainer on.
Okay. So this has to do with people who have been arrested, but not people who have been convicted of anything. The administration is saying that they are focusing on criminals who are undocumented, right? People who have committed a crime. Are you seeing that play out in the numbers that you're seeing so far?
It hasn't changed because I'm not aware of ICE just bringing somebody in for us to hold them. Mm-hmm. So these are people that actually have committed a crime and have been arrested by a law enforcement officer for state charges. It's that simple.
State charges. You are under a court order at MCSO from the days of Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who you worked under, to basically to stay out of immigration enforcement, right, unless somebody has committed a state crime. How do you ride that line? Like, what's your office's role policy to make sure that you don't overstep it?
There is no line for us. It is a solid wall, and we have not been involved in dealing with people that are in the country illegally and just for being undocumented. Mm-hmm. We don't do that. What we do is we enforce the state law.
We have seen workplace raids in other parts of the country, potentially here in Arizona. They were a hallmark of immigration enforcement under Sheriff Joe Arpaio's reign. Would you stay away from those as well?
Yes, because, again, we have a court order that we're supposed to stay away from that. And it's really a federal issue. I mean, local law enforcement can get involved if they have certain laws that are enacted, which we don't have here. So it is absolutely a federal issue at this point.
Okay. Let me ask you about that court order, because you're entering the office following a Democrat who ran against Arpaio and in the kind of the wake of a lot of these things, right? You were held in contempt of court, so was the sheriff at the time. I wonder what you think about how Pinzon left office, right? He left a little early saying, basically, my hands are tied because of this court order. I cannot run this office the way I want to. Are you concerned about that?
Well, he was also held in contempt twice, right? And so I'm sure he was frustrated, just like I am, because you run for sheriff and you get elected by the people. And I got well over a million votes from basically a support of over a million people here in Maricopa County. And I cannot run the sheriff's office the way I see fit, because everything has to go through the monitor process, and the plaintiff's counsel has to approve things, and even transferring people. So I can see where Sheriff Pinzon was very frustrated with that, and I am too. But I learned how to deal with it back when I was the chief deputy for mm-hmm. Sheriff Joe. So I knew very well coming into this job, this was going to be a problem, but this is also going to be a problem that we can solve.
So do you anticipate being able to get out from under those court orders to comply?
Well, let me just say, Paul Pinzon's staff, I haven't really changed very many of them, because they're a bunch of dedicated employees, deputy sheriffs, detention officers, civilian employees that have been working damn hard to comply with the court's order, and we're going to continue doing that.
What are some of the barriers to that from your point of view so far?
Well, barriers are measurements, and a measurement on how long it takes to make a traffic stop. How many Hispanic drivers did you stop compared to white drivers? You know, all those kinds of things are measured. And you would think there would be a baseline. of what acceptable behavior is on the part of a deputy sheriff.
Mm-hmm.
But there really isn't. And I believe we're the only law enforcement agency in the country that is actually doing this and getting this deep involved in our traffic stops, our traffic stop data, the review of the body worn cameras on every traffic stop, and bringing the deputies in after they make a traffic stop and discussing it with them and all that. So I'm very confident there is no racial profiling. There is no racial bias going on at the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office, and there hasn't been for 10 years.
Okay.
And so the frustration is, how do we finish this? How do we tie this package up into a bow so we can present it to the judge? And that's the part of the problem, because the court monitor is really the one that needs to do that. And he says he's not really prepared to do that yet.
Hmm. So you have a monitor you're dealing with, but you're also dealing with Judge Murray Snow, who was overseeing the case when, you know, when all of this happened initially, accused you of lying to him, basically said you held you in contempt of court. Do you think that that relationship, that history, could make this harder?
Well, I'd like to tell all your listeners out there, I was never untruthful. Never. He just couldn't understand something that I was trying to tell him. He said I was less than truthful. That's mm-hmm. Those are the words he used. You know, this came up during the campaign. You know, during one of the debates, they asked me this question out of left field. I wasn't prepared for it. Well, what do you think the judge is going to say if you become the sheriff?
Right.
What do you think he's going to think? And I think he's going to be happy. He's going to be happy because I know this system. I know the court order. I know the monitor and all the people involved. So I can get there from day one and continue to comply like I did up until the very last day I worked there in December of 2016. We worked hard for 3 years to build that foundation for compliance. And it looks like now maybe I might have the opportunity to finish it up.
All right. And we'll talk more about what that might look like in the Latino community here in just a moment. That is Maricopa County Sheriff Jerry Sheridan. More of our conversation after the break. Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a new adventure novel is examining transphobia in a Jewish mythology setting.
And let's return now to my conversation with new Maricopa County Sheriff Jerry Sheridan. So you talked about frustrations with trying to comply with this court order and all of the kind of steps you have to go through and very basic things to try to comply with it. Do you agree, though, with the findings? Do you think that the sheriff's department at the time under you and Arpaio was racially profiling?
I don't believe we were racially profiling. What we did as an organization that I didn't agree with when we were doing it, by the way, mm-hmm. was targeting Hispanic neighborhoods to do saturation patrols. And that's not a good way to do law enforcement. And we had lengthy discussions with Sheriff Arpaio about that back in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he was the sheriff, so he did what he wanted to do.
The court found that you violated the civil rights of Latino citizens. Now coming back into office, how do you rebuild with those communities? How do you build trust, which is so important, as we know, between law enforcement and the community in which it works?
I've been working very hard at that, even during the campaign. You know, the town of Guadalupe is one of our contract towns that we provide the full law enforcement service to them. I reached out to the mayor. I got the mayor's support and some of the council members. The chairman of the Pascua-Yaqui tribe, which mm-hmm. is a large population in Guadalupe, he supported me. I've gone to lunch with some of the leaders of Chicanos por la Casa in the past month. And just a week and a half ago, I had the Mexican consulate in my office. So I've been doing everything that I possibly can with the leadership mm-hmm. of the Hispanic community here in Maricopa County. It's the zealots, the agitators that don't want to believe the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office is not a racist organization, that continue to beat the drum.
Mm.
And that's just a false narrative on their part. And the deputies that we have working for us, working for you, every citizen in this county, are good people doing a great job.
especially amid the sort of mass deportation, anti-immigrant environment that we're in right now politically, and the big conversation that's happening around that right now, do you anticipate that being a further challenge?
No.
Simple as that?
Simple as that.
Let me ask you about efforts at the state capitol to pass some legislation this session that would have to do with you, right? It would compel law enforcement to cooperate with ICE. It sounds like your department is doing that. What kind of challenge would laws like that pose to your agency, given that court order, though, and given the stipulation that it has to be somebody accused of or arrested for a state crime?
Correct. The biggest problem we would have is funding. Because as of right now, I just read the bill before I came here, mm-hmm. and there's no funding for law enforcement anywhere, especially for the sheriffs, because housing individuals is an expensive endeavor, and it costs about $145 a day to keep somebody in the county jail. And so those numbers can add up pretty darn quick. And so if you're going to mandate laws, you need to also provide the resources and the funding for us to enforce those laws.
And funding may be one thing, but staffing is also a big issue for MCSO right now, right? In terms of just not having the deputies, not having the correctional officers to do the work.
It's very critical right now. And we're about 840 detention officers short, about 120 deputies short. And when you only have 740 deputies, that's a pretty big impact. But really, when you look at it, the people that show up to work every day is about 50% of what staffing levels should be. Mm. And that's not good for the officers in the jail. They have the toughest job in law enforcement. They also get the least amount of respect. And they have what I consider the most important part in the criminal justice system is keeping the bad guys behind bars. And so their staff, they're working overtime, and, you know, that gets old after a while. It's the same thing with deputies. Deputies work a lot of overtime, and, you know, fatigue can set in. They can make mistakes. You know, bad things can happen. You can drive a car, fall asleep because you just work two shifts in a row. Mm. You know, you're not thinking right. And so it does have impacts on us, right, with the staffing level, not just from, you know, how many inmates we can house.
So how do you change that? How do you change the narrative?
Well, I just came from Scottsdale Community College. We were doing a recruitment out there, and the sheriff himself went out there and shaking hands. I had a couple of people I talked to, and that's how you do it. You go out there, and there's a lot of people that want to get involved in law enforcement, and we just need to go out there and find them and recruit them to come work for us.
Last question for you, Sheriff. You have said many times throughout this campaign that you are not Joe Arpaio. How do you want to be different?
Well, I am not Joe Arpaio because I don't enjoy the media attention. Hmm. And matter of fact, I've turned down some media interviews because that's not who I am. I've always been an operations person, and that means to get things done and do that. And it was always good when I worked for Arpaio because he wanted to do it all. And that was great because I didn't want to do any of it. But now that I'm the sheriff, I've got to go out there and let the people know. Again, all 4.6 million people, I work for them. They elected me as their sheriff. And so I also need to communicate because they're my bosses. Hey, boss, this is what we did today. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to need to use the media to be able to do that.
That's a big difference.
That's a huge difference because it's not something that I seek and enjoy.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you coming in for an interview then. That is Maricopa County Sheriff Jerry Sheridan joining us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. A number of European leaders are meeting today in Paris for an emergency summit. They'll be talking about the ongoing war in Ukraine. The meeting is in response to concerns on the continent that the U.S. is moving ahead with Russia on peace talks, leaving Europe out. With me via Skype for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Pete Ross in London. And Pete, what can you tell us about this gathering?
Yeah, there's been a lot of reaction in the last sort of 24 hours or so to comments made by Donald Trump over the weekend about his plans to negotiate an end of the war, or to negotiate the end of the war in Ukraine directly with Russia, as you say, cutting out Ukraine, or proposing to cut out Ukraine and Europe. So this meeting taking place in Paris today, European leaders from several European nations hoping to present a united front on the issues that perhaps matter the most to Donald Trump, which you could suggest is defence spending and the continent's future security, or rather who's responsible for the future security of the continent. Now, I think it's fair to say the Trump administration has not been 100% clear on exactly what it wants to do about the Ukraine. There have been some mixed messages over the weekend. So I think Europe's leaders see a small window of opportunity to unite and to prove to Donald Trump that they're taking action and that they should be involved in these talks with Russia about Ukraine's future. I think there's, you know, a lot of shock amongst those leaders. And it's, to be honest, it's about more than Ukraine. It's about where this might lead. In many ways, you know, today, Monday, Europe is waking up to the cold realization that things have changed. We have perhaps heard this expression, there's a new sheriff in town in relation to Donald Trump. And I think that is now dawning on Europe, that it can no longer rely, at least on this current administration in Washington, that it's not prioritizing relations with Europe or indeed its defense, something that Europe has, you know, been able to rely on through successive administrations following the end of World War II. So one thing to say about today's summit, which is taking place in Paris, as we've mentioned, it's not all European countries that will be represented, just those with some military heft. So that's the UK, France, Germany, Italy, Poland, Spain, and Denmark. And as I mentioned before, they'll be looking to try and come together on some sort of consensus, some sort of message or package that they can sell to Donald Trump. Just one thing I want to mention on this, though, even though that's not even all European nations, just a small number of them, getting any sort of consensus at all, I think, is going to be a little bit tricky. But that is indeed what they'll be hoping to do, as I said, in order to sell some sort of plan to Donald Trump and to get in, crucially, to get in and into those negotiations, which we're told are going to be taking place as soon as Tuesday this week.
Sure. So, Pete, staying in Europe, in Germany now, where voters there will head to the polls on Sunday. It's a snap election, and it comes at a time of heightened political uncertainty with deep divisions over the country's economic future as well as its immigration policies. So this seems like a pretty significant vote in Germany.
Yeah, I mean, Germany is Europe's biggest economy, and a stable and steady Germany is important for the bloc. But you mentioned heightened political uncertainty, and we've just talked about, you know, the comments from the White House over the weekend, which has added to that uncertainty. So I think you're absolutely right. This was a highly significant vote, which is becoming more significant, you know, with each passing day. Just to talk about the election in Germany specifically, the vote will happen this coming Sunday, and it will decide who's going to be the next leader of the country. Friedrich Merz's Conservative Christian Democrat Party are the favourite to become to win the biggest share of the vote. However, it is unlikely, there are no polls pointing at the moment, it's unlikely that they will win outright power. So attention turns to who might they form a coalition government with. And leading the polls for that one is the AfD party, an extreme far-right party, which has come to some prominence, particularly recently, because it enjoys the support of Elon Musk, who has defended the party in recent months and promoted and even spoken online at gatherings as well. So that's sort of thrown it into the spotlight internationally. But as I said, it's a far-right party. All the major parties in Germany have said that they will not work together with the AfD to form a government. However, you know, politicians change their mind. And as I said, the polls are certainly pointing to no outright victor. And if the AfD does, as some polls suggest, that it might get as much as 20% of the vote, it'll be very difficult for the next German government to be formed without it.
Interesting. So, Pete, let's finish today with the continuing political crisis in South Korea that follows the impeachment of the country's president. What's the latest there?
Yeah, the political crisis in Korea rolls on. It's gone quiet recently, but I think we might see some more protesters back on the street or more demonstrations back on the streets this week, perhaps, because South Korea's Constitutional Court is holding another hearing this week to decide whether President Yoon Suk-yeol should be permanently removed from office following his ill-fated martial law declaration last year. It's not immediately clear if this next hearing would be the last before a verdict is delivered on that, or if the court would hold a couple more sessions, therefore as continuing the political uncertainty. If the court decides that the impeachment is valid, then Yoon will be immediately removed from office, and that will trigger a presidential election that must take place within 60 days. However, the court could rule in favour of Yoon, and that would mean that would restore his powers, but then the president's legal travails would still be far from over as he faces a separate criminal case on charges of insurrection. There has been precedent for this before in South Korea. There's been two presidents that have been impeached in its past. One was upheld and the other wasn't. So we could look to that to suggest that it could go either way. I think the main thing to say here is that the process rolls on, the uncertainty remains, and it could still be several weeks, if not months, until things stabilize on the South Korean peninsula.
Yeah, I have to keep our eye on that one as well. All right. That is the BBC's Pete Ross in London. Pete, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
When Arizona voters overwhelmingly passed Proposition 314 in November, they made a clear statement about their desire for more action on illegal immigration in our state. But there was a problem that many in law enforcement pointed out right away. There was no funding attached to the measure. Prop 314 makes illegally crossing the border a crime in our state, allowing law enforcement to arrest migrants they have reason to believe committed it. But how could they enforce it without the funding to make it happen? Well, Republican lawmakers at the state capitol are working to fix that problem. But our next guest this morning reports there's a big potential legal issue with their solution. I spoke with the Arizona Mirror's reporter Jared McDonald Evoy more about it.
Even before that law was passed, we had members of law enforcement, particularly the state's law enforcement agency, the Department of Public Safety, telling lawmakers that they were concerned about, you know, if this passed, it would be basically an unfunded mandate. Law enforcement would be taking on extra duties and would be having to arrest and process people in a way that they don't currently do. And they were worried about, you know, having the funding and even the space to do that.
Right. And many law enforcement agencies around the state are really understaffed right now, too. So this would be a further challenge, it sounds like.
Correct. DPS, the state's main law enforcement agency, they've been having issues with staffing, funding. They've been having retention issues. You got areas of the state where they patrol where there might only be one trooper in a massive several hundred mile radius at times. So law enforcement really was sounding the alarm before this was passed and then after it was passed that, look, we don't know if we have the manpower or capabilities to do this. You even have some sheriffs down in the border communities that have said, we don't know if we have the detention facilities built out yet to enforce this as well.
Okay, so lawmakers at the state capitol are trying to solve this funding problem with another piece of legislation that they have introduced already. Tell us what it would do.
House Bill 2606, it gives $50 million to the Department of Public Safety to basically enforce Prop 314. This money then would be able to be used by DPS to give out to other local law enforcement agencies as they kind of deem fit in order to make sure that Prop 314 can be enforced and that they have the resources they need.
Yeah. Okay. So where would this money come from?
The money is set aside in the legislation to be pulled from the state's general fund. That's the fund that the state uses for all sorts of different things, from education to law enforcement.
Right. But you point out in a recent piece that there's an issue here, that this might set off kind of a constitutional showdown.
Correct. The Arizona Constitution requires that any ballot measure that increases state funding to provide money to pay for it. It also says that you can't take that money from the state's general operating fund or the general fund. This proposal would appropriate money directly from the general fund. So it could ultimately set up a scenario where if this were to pass and be used to enforce 314, someone could then file a lawsuit to try to strike down 314 as well, declaring it unconstitutional.
Right. So you reported on the hearing that this legislation had at the state legislature. Have lawmakers commented on that potential problem at this point?
Lawmakers have not publicly commented on the constitutionality of this measure. In a committee hearing where this bill was passed earlier this week, there was no discussion about that. The discussion was mainly centered around the immigration policies we're seeing from the federal government and how that is impacting local communities, as well as a lot of discussion about, you know, the voters did overwhelmingly pass Prop 314 mm-hmm. and are clearly wanting to see some sort of action on immigration. Those were really the main key talking points, but no one brought up the possible issues with the funding that have been brought up in the past or brought up now.
Yeah, yeah. And we should point out that Prop 314, though voters did overwhelmingly pass it, is contingent upon another law, a similar law in Texas, and kind of what happens with that. Is it possible, Jared, this could never be enforced anyway?
Correct. There is currently a lawsuit against the Texas-based law, which this Prop 314 was modeled after, and that's kind of working its way through the courts. And if that law is deemed ultimately unconstitutional or non-enforceable, that would make Prop 314 basically moot.
Yeah. Okay. So this is just one measure at the state capitol right now that is aimed at immigration enforcement. As you mentioned, lawmakers seem very cognizant of the fact that the electorate here wants to see something happen on immigration. And in, especially kind of in light of the mass deportations that we're seeing coming from the Trump administration already, what are lawmakers here looking to do? We have competing measures kind of from both sides.
Yeah, correct. The Democrats and the Republicans have both kind of introduced their own immigration measures. On the Republican side, you have Senate President Warren Peterson. He has created what they're calling the Arizona ICE Act, which requires law enforcement to enter into these 287G agreements by next year. 10% of every officer in every law enforcement organization would have to participate in these. And 287Gs are these agreements with federal authorities like ICE, and it deputizes them to do certain immigration duties. This kind of became prominent back here in Arizona during the Arpaio years when mm-hmm. he was in entering into these agreements and was kind of found to be racially profiling some of his deputies who had entered into these agreements.
Right. So only the GOP bill here will likely get a hearing. Should we expect that to be vetoed by the governor?
It's unclear if it will be vetoed by the governor currently. She has not directly answered questions on that. And we've seen a bit of a shift on the governor, as well as other key large Democrats in the state, such as Mark Kelly and Ruben Gallego, mm-hmm. who are supporting more hardline immigration policies, such as the Laken Riley Act. So it's unclear if, given, you know, her competitive race in 2026, if this is something that she will veto or allow to go forward. On the flip side of that, the Dems have pushed what they're calling the Immigration Trust Act at the legislature, which would basically do the opposite of what the Republican measure would do. It would bar law enforcement cities, localities from searching, questioning, or arresting someone solely based on suspicion of their immigration status.
Yeah, basically opposites entirely. All right, we will leave it there for now. Lots to watch for. Jared McDonald, Evoy, joining us, reporter with the Arizona Mirror. Thank you, Jared. Appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Within hours of taking office, President Trump signed an executive order saying the country's official policy is that there are two genders, male and female. State legislatures across the country continue to debate bills dealing with who can use which bathrooms and play on which school sports teams. It is into this environment that a new novel for young adults hits the shelves. A World Worth Saving tells the story of a trans teenager and his struggles with his parents. But it also has a supernatural element to it, a golem that protects trans kids. A golem is a character in Jewish folklore. Kyle Lukoff is the book's author. He says his life is full of great people trying to give him ideas for books and him not wanting to write those books, except in this case. I spoke with him earlier and asked what sounded so good to him about this idea.
Well, I had been thinking about writing something fantasy adventure style, sort of like the Percy Jackson books, just because I love those books so much and mm-hmm. I know how popular they are with kids. And I was just sort of mulling this idea over casually, but I didn't know really what I wanted to be about. And when I realized that that could sort of be the hook, it all slowly started to come together for me. But this book took a much longer time than any of my other novels for me to figure out what it was really about. I'd say it took probably about 2 years before I finally got the big ideas in place behind it.
Why do you think that was the case?
I think because, for one, this book is dealing with a lot more than my other novels. My other novels have been wonderful, and they've also been relatively straightforward stories where there's kind of one big idea that I'm curious about or looking at. And in this one, there were several different ideas that I was trying to put together all at once. And then also just the scope of what I was dealing with was so much larger. So I'm dealing with, I'm writing about a trans kid from an unsupportive family. I'm trying to talk about the current anti-trans panic that we're in right now, but I also wanted it to be a very Jewish story dealing with history and mythology and folklore and theory. And I didn't know how all of those ideas were going to fit together. And it just feels like magic. Like at some point, I just realized what was going on and how these all were going to blend together. And it just came to me.
Huh. So, not being a writer of books myself, I can imagine that it would be sort of an easy trap to fall into once you have decided to go sort of down the supernatural route, that it could get kind of cheesy maybe and could sort of take over some of the other messages and ideas that you're trying to get to. I'm curious if that's something that was going through your mind as you were writing this, that yes, I want to have a supernatural component here, but there's also some very serious issues and serious ideas I'm trying to get out, and I don't want those to be overtaken by this mythical creature.
Very much so, yeah. I'd say that there are two large things that I was trying to avoid in this. One was that I didn't want it to be the classic chosen one narrative. I don't like the idea that like one person is the most magic and special boy and the only one who can fix things when we know that all human beings have the capacity for incredible things. And that also it is never just one person. It is always community and it's always solidarity and it's always who you choose to align yourself with. So I want to try to book about one person where he also wasn't just the magic special one. And also, I didn't want to write the kind of realistic fantasy that relied on cheap magic. I wanted all of the supernatural elements to feel, if not realistic, then at least plausible within the context of Jewish teaching and Jewish learning. And I didn't know very much about that when I started writing this book. It took tons of research and tons of thinking about what I read and what I learned and how that could connect to the story itself. I didn't want to just hand wave it away and say, like, there was magic. He said a magic spell. And that I think is how I avoided making it cheesy. I tried to avoid the two major tropes of like the one chosen one and then a hand-waving approach to how it's all fitting together.
Well, on that second point, I would imagine that it kind of becomes an issue of credibility with your readers, right? Because as you say, the main character is a trans child with unsupportive parents, and there are other trans kids who also have unsupportive parents. And I would think that if you just use some supernatural, feature to make the parents suddenly understand who their kids are, the readers would be like, that's not really how life works.
Yeah, that's true. I also didn't want to make it seem like every type of like hatred or bigotry is driven by supernatural forces. There's definitely some of that, but I also think that that lets human beings off the hook.
Interesting. So you mentioned sort of the moment that we are in and what it means for people in the trans community. How much did that play into not just your desire to write this book, but how you wrote it and maybe how the characters evolved throughout it?
I think that's part of what made this book so hard for me to write. I've said before, with my first two novels, Too Bright to See, and then my second novel, Different Kinds of Fruit, they very much deal with trans characters and trans themes, but they don't really talk about transphobia. And that is because I'm not very interested in transphobia. I don't think that there's anything that it has to teach me. There's nothing there that I'm curious about. There's nothing in there that I want to engage with intellectually. It's all just reheated talking points and moral panics that have been pretty much unchanged for decades upon decades. However, if I was going to write this book about a golem protecting a trans kid, he needed to be protected from something. And there's a limited number of things in this world that well, no, that's not true. There's an unlimited number of things that people need to be protected from. However, in the story as it came to me, I knew that I could not avoid this current iteration of anti-trans sentiment and transphobic backlash. And it was hard for me because, again, there's nothing there that I find interesting. So I had to find a way to write about that subject in a way that felt compelling to me, which I think is part of why I wanted to weave in elements of Jewish teaching as it relates to periods of transition or liminal moments or liminal spaces, because that I find much more interesting than whatever people have to say about us at any given moment.
I know for a lot of children's authors, it's really important that readers are seen in the pages of the book, that either they feel represented, or if the book is not about somebody like them, that they can learn about somebody maybe who is different from them and understand what their life is like and what they deal with and what they go through and that kind of thing. How much of that played into what you wrote in this story?
This is my 16th or 17th book, and it is my first book that includes a Jewish character. And what's interesting is that I've been Jewish since the day that I was born, but I only came out as trans when I was in my 20s. But all of my books are about trans people. And I think, a friend of mine told me that they see more of me in this book than they have seen in any of my other books. And I think that that is because the experience of growing up as a Jewish kid in a part of the world that had a tiny, tiny, tiny Jewish community. I think there were like two other Jewish kids in my high school of 2000. That had more of an effect on how I see myself and how I see the world than really anything else has.
All right, that is Kyle Lukoff, children's author. New book is called A World Worth Saving. Kyle, really nice to talk to you. Thank you.
You too. Thanks so much, Mark.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.